The Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5. Scotland Yard's looking into whether a crime has been committed in the Keith Vaz scandal. The MP quit as chairman of the Commons Home Affairs Committee on Tuesday after a Sunday paper claimed he'd paid for the services of two male escorts and offered to buy cocaine. Our chief political correspondent John Craig says police have been asked to investigate the matter.
The Conservative MP Anne Bridgen wrote to Scotland Yard calling for...
Welcome to The Politics Show. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and the disappearing Sky Murdoch News. Instead, welcome to the home of everything the government don't want you to know. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is the leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news on the road to Damascus, big conference in London of the so-called Syrian opposition this week, but they say Assad has to go, just as it's looking like he may win, only to find NATO in the form of the Turks occupying the north of his country. Also, Menwith Hill, a square mile of America in the wilds of the Yorkshire Moors. Snowden revelations this week prove a programme called Ghost Hunter has been doing the targeting of the drone strikes. So why have none of the London media covered this most important revelation about war crimes on British soil? Also, it's the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Stand by for waves of propaganda, folks. But we hear from Manfred Petrisch, who was a regular visitor to the New York's World Trade Center, as well as Chris Bolin, who looks at the foreknowledge, evidence many people were warned not to go to work that day. And they were warned by a company set up by a man we featured on this show last week as possibly complicit in the London bombings. He stole $33 million and was on the run from the New York Securities and Exchange Commission, and he's just returned to a jail in America. His name's Kobe Alexander, his company Odigo. Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Onto our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Don't seem to have the weather forecast here. I don't know if that might appear at some point in the near future. Well, we'll see, and let's hope so. But anyway, let's just move straight on to hear from Gary Hopkins. He's the leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
Now, it's good to have you on because you were very, very quick last time. You came in just at the very end of the show because you were called away to an important meeting. And, you know, that's exactly what's happened to Craig Cheney. He booked in on the show a month ago. He's one of the senior people now in the Labour administration at Bristol City Council, but I got a text from him sort of mid-late afternoon, about one, something like that, saying, oh, I can't do it. So you stepped into the breach. Thanks very much for doing that, Gary.
No problem.
First of all, what's the this that you've been getting very involved in buses, as good old First Bus are cutting?
Yeah, last time I was due on here, I was actually held up in a meeting. Myself and a colleague were actually negotiating with Wessex Buses to take over a route that First Bus had actually abandoned in South Bristol, the 51 route. And that was vital to our community. Many people, a lot of old elderly people, very important for commerce and lots of shops in our area. And First Bus were abusing their monopoly position to try and force people to move on to a nearby bus route, and had cancelled things. And unfortunately, the City Council had sat on the information for nearly a month, so myself and colleagues from Whitchurch and Hengrove Ward had to work like billio to get a replacement. And I'm glad to say that Wessex Bus have actually stepped in and are actually running a better service than First were running before, and have agreed to share profits with community groups.
Well, that's amazing story. How come first? I mean, surely there must be a bit of a better way of doing this rather than sort of fire brigade management. It sounds like this had to happen here. That is to say, if first decide they don't want to run a route, surely it's immediately open for tender for all sorts of other groups, including brand new companies, if they want to run that route.
Well, it was a commercial route, apart from some small subsidy that first were getting into for running later evening services. And staggeringly, council officers actually agreed for that subsidy to move from the service that they'd cancelled onto a nearby one. So they would get an extra subsidy for cutting a service. Most of the services within Bristol are commercial. They're run for profit by the companies, and that's fine. But what's happening at the moment is that the subsidised services or the contracted services by the council are all up for review, and there's £2 million spent on there, and it's very, very obvious that the administration are actually looking to save quite a lot of that money. So even more services might be at risk following the cuts that First in particular made just a week or two ago.
Right, call me an imbecile if you want, but I thought the whole point of privatising bus services was so that we, the public, the council taxpayers, the income taxpayers, didn't have to subsidise buses, because that was the whole reason it was put forward in the first place, to privatise them.
Well, the system is the worst of all worlds at the moment, because what happens is some routes are extremely profitable and the likes of First grab the profits from them and say thank you very much and tuck the money in their back pockets. Well, there's other routes that the council regard as important for the overall network and for looking after people to make certain as a service. They say, we can't make a profit on that, you're going to have to pay us a subsidy. So we get the worst of all worlds. What we actually need is a properly franchised system so that the profitable routes actually subsidise the slightly less profitable, so we have a better overall network.
Is there any prospect of that?
Well, the bus bill going through Parliament at the moment does promise the ability for the region to be able to grab that power, and that would be a significant step forward.
The main man round here on all this stuff is Mark Bradshaw. any chance of, do you think, of him sort of almost like Captain Fantastic picking this up and saying, yeah, we're going to do it and nothing's going to stop me?
We don't know what the attitude is on this. I mean, the amusing thing was, on the 51 bus, he was telling my colleague on the day that we negotiated the replacement, you're wasting your time on that campaign because First they've walked away, nobody else is going to want that service. And we'd already come to an agreement with Wessex on that the day before. So that's Mark Bradshaw. In fact, the deal was held up slightly while I tried to get their press release together. But, you know, the last mayor actually said franchising wasn't necessary in Bristol, even if you've got the powers, which is absolute lunacy. We've not got a clear statement from the new mayor yet on whether he will fully embrace franchising, and I'm asking questions about this on Tuesday if the power is given to the West of England, because it's absolutely central.
The other big problem with transport, I mean, those sitting listening to this in their cars right now, I can think, you know, you can have a Cheshire Cat smile on your face, because public transport in this city is an absolute disaster in many ways, and one of the ones that's looming on the horizon now is the lack of anyone wants to actually run the metro bus. So there's all this delays right in the city centre and up the M32, and there's various other places along the route where there are roadworks, cones in the middle of the road. You know, I was driving through the city centre yesterday with a whole load of cones, you know, a whole lane blocked off with cones, nothing happening in it, no reason to block it off. But anyway, all these delays, and yet still we're being told that's going to be going all year, it's not going to be finished until next year, and then there might be nobody to run the metro bus at the end of the day. Unbelievable incompetence.
It's been staggeringly badly handled. The tendering for the park and ride services was made a complete mess of over recent months, I'm afraid. And I'm afraid the negotiations over the metro bus have been just as bad. You need firms, if they're going to run an operation like that, need clarity. They need to know how long they'd be having the contract for, and they need to know where they stand. I'm afraid that Councillor Bradshaw has been waffling on about partnerships rather than proper contracts, and that's putting off potential operators.
One of the latest things we've heard is that Bristol Metro Bus is in negotiations with operators. It does seem to me actually insane in a way to set off on this metro bus journey, spending all this public money, loads of course of our council tax money, on building this guided bus rail that many people say is a very bad way to run any kind of public transport system. Certainly in France, I can't remember the name of the city in France that did this, and then a few years afterwards just decided to scrap the whole system and turn it into a tram. Also, we've heard from Cambridge that all sorts of problems with their equivalent guided busway in Cambridge, but that they would actually set off on spending all this money, actually not having anybody in place to run the buses. I mean, Gary, please explain to me, how does anybody do that?
Well, in actual fact, when the Great Bristol Bus Network was brought in and the new bus lanes down the main roads, etc., it was an extreme success.
Well, you say that, but that's the bonkers bus stops, isn't it? These bus stops that go out into the middle of the road, where the cyclists have to go into oncoming traffic to get past the bus, which just seems to me, you know, a very strange way to implement safety on the roads.
In actual fact, the bus usage went up dramatically, and it turned the corner for bus operation in Bristol. It meant that bus operators could make a decent profit, which means that you can therefore run a proper franchise system and get a service that actually works.
And that's mostly to do with making sure the buses can actually go rather than sit in traffic jams, is it?
Exactly, yes. It's absolutely essential. Mind you, the operators, like First, have not done their bit properly. They should have cashless buses. They should, so they're not sat at the bus stops while people fiddle around for their change and that sort of thing. So they have not done everything that they can to speed things up.
Well, that's absolutely understandable. A lot of people don't want to pay in cash for the bus. And also, if you've got £5 in your pocket, and they will say to you, oh, you can't get on this bus, I mean, that's insane as well.
No, not if you have a proper system, which they have in London, and it works extremely well.
But it's
well.
No good for visitors.
Where you can buy
it. Just a minute. It's no good for visitors, is it? If the visitors have got to go through some system, like an Oyster card system, get some special card, the whole point of cash is you can use it for everything.
Exactly. And basically, what's was put in originally for the Metrobus, as an example, was points to buy tickets practically everywhere with cash, but not while the buses stood stationary at the bus stop.
I've got another good idea, which is one that Kevin Livingstone did in London, is try and make the public transport free, and another one which is use just £1 for a ticket or £2 for a ticket, so you haven't got loads and loads of cash.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the reasons why the new 51 that we've got in South Bristol is successful, because they've got a £1, £2 and £3 system, significantly cheaper fares, and people are loving it already. I mean, we're getting emails after email saying, my God, this is better.
Amazing. People emailing their councillors about how wonderful Bristol's buses are. I think you should preserve those emails. Oh. Put them up on the wall, Gary, and and put them up on the council.
It's a fairly unique situation, after all, that first bus walk away and another operator comes in and people say, hang on, this is better.
So is there any prospect of sorting this out generally? I mean, particularly the Metro bus, because I know originally it's not personally your problem to sort out, it's Mark Bradshaw's, but I can see no... I mean, looking at the recent news articles about it over the last couple of months, Bristol Metro bus scheme may need public cash, the BBC are saying. Public may have to help fund Metro bus as talks to find an operator stall. That's in the Bristol Post. The Metro bus in negotiations, that's in Transport Network on their website. It's just no, it doesn't seem like anything's going to happen here. So what's happening with Metrobus? What's your
thoughts? Well, I mean, you know, councillors are not told anything by the administration on this sort of thing. And basically, there are detailed negotiations going on. But bluntly, it is, over a period of a few years, a licence to print money for an operator. And if it was handled properly, there would be a queue of operators wanting to run that service.
So why aren't they?
Well, all I can point you at is recent experience. The tendering for the park and ride was completely fouled up. I've just given the example of the 51 bus where, you know, we allowed an operator to walk away, leaving a vital service, and local councillors had to go along and do the negotiation and sort it out.
Well, is it possible
the administration?
With Metrobus that something a bit like the East Coast Main Line might happen, where the city council, central government say, well, actually, we're going to have to run this ourselves, because they can't build this and then just have no buses on it?
Well, and that's one possibility that has to be looked at. And if operators know that somebody else will step in, I think you'll find that their negotiating position will actually change.
So I wonder if people driving home through the traffic jams and the queues night after night, morning after morning, will be wishing they could see an effigy of Mark Bradshaw burning up the M32 if he can't get this sorted out. What do you think he can?
I don't have the most enormous confidence in his ability to negotiate.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, got to bring you in on this. I mean, we're talking really here about privatisation of public transport, massive subsidies going, even though that was the reason it was privatised in the first place, to stop it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Gary put his finger on it with some of the routes are profitable and some of them aren't. And, of course, what you'd be able to do if it was publicly on public ownership is you cross-subsidise the whole thing. We've got used to things being badly managed in this country over decades, so we just get used to, you know, we just get used to the rubbish way things are. But of course, foreigners come here and they look at the way we run our public transport and they roll their eyes and scratch their heads. You know, in Seattle, for example, all buses are free and have been for ages.
Is that beyond the realms of possibility, Gary, the idea of free public transport? Because that's one way to get people out of their cars.
Oh, well, it certainly would be.
If it's reliable.
You should be able to make it reliable, because if you've got less cars on the road, the congestion would reduce.
Now, I can remember, this is when I was going to secondary school, I used to catch a bus down in South London years and years ago. Must have been in the early 80s, when I turned up for my bus one morning and the bus conductor said, well, that's 3.5p, sir. Well, I don't know if he said sir, but anyway, it had been 5p the day before. The fares started going down in London. I think, Martin, it's fair to say that there was a concerted effort to make sure that public transport in London was not allowed to be free, but it is in some cities, isn't it?
Well, what Ken Livingstone tried to do initially with his Fares Fair campaign was reduce, I remember all fares were reduced to £1 and so on. Of course, what he's actually increasing...
Just a minute, because that was a long time after. That was when he became Mayor of London. Fares fair, I mean, we were talking about the much, much lower fares in those days.
Yeah.
And this is the early 1980s, when he reduced fares to £1.
Yeah,
that was what he did when he became...
Yeah, and obviously, you know, he hadn't managed to make it free, but, I mean, he was basically using the business rates on the City of London to subsidise public transport.
He was also doing deals, wasn't he, with Hugo Chavez to bring diesel over from Venezuela.
Well, that was later on. Chavez wasn't in power at that stage.
Cross-subsidising. The idea, we'll send you some transport expertise to Venezuela, so long as you can bring in some nice cheap diesel,
well,
we can run our buses.
That's a later era. But in the early era, I mean, what actually happened is he was taken to court, and the House of Lords ruled that London transport had to be run at a profit. Which was absurd, because nobody runs a public transport system in a city the size of London at a profit. So it was an absurd ruling, but on that basis the whole thing was overturned, and therefore his policy of trying to subsidise public transport to keep the level of car use down and so on was overturned by the House of Lords, claiming that he had to make it run at a profit.
And it was,
which
my
was absurd.
My local authority that took him to court, I'm afraid, Bromley Council, they called them vandals in ermine, and they decided that the... in fact, they got rid of the GLC completely, didn't they? Actually, abolished.
Right. Well, eventually they got rid of the GLC completely because he couldn't be defeated in a democratic election. So they then had a whole period of no government for London at all. And then, of course, when it came back, the powers of the GLC had been completely changed. For example, the business rate was no longer in the hands of the council. And, of course, that was, as Livingston said in the early 80s, by raising business rates on the City of London, it's got fantastic property prices, I can get a huge slush fund to spend on all sorts of things in the poorer areas,
Gary,
of the city.
One group of people that the system we've got here in Bristol really benefits is the oil companies, isn't it? Because everyone has got to have their own car. It's just, you know, the idea is that there is no real proper public provision of getting you to and from work, although of course some people have to use it. It's there if you really have to, but everyone is being encouraged to buy a car in this age of trying to stop congestion.
Well, I mean, quite right that we need to, in actual fact, improve the public transport system, because otherwise it's not just in the short term but the long term. If people haven't got a system that they can trust in the long term, they have to get the car or the second car, because it's the only way they can actually get around. It's quite interesting, actually, in that the businesses at Broadwalk shopping centre in Knowle, they all came together to campaign with us on this, and actually the management of the shopping centre said, look, you know, we've got a nice free car park, but actually so many of our customers arrive on the bus, you cut that bus and it undermines our profitability for the whole shopping area. So businesses were campaigning with us on this as well.
Let's just recycle, go back a tiny bit to our two-weekend weather forecast, because I've got that now. I managed to find it at the bottom of my little stack of scripts here. It's tonight lows of 16 Celsius and showers. This weekend, highs of 21 Celsius. Showers in the morning and sunny spells in the afternoon on Saturday, sunny spells on Sunday. So often, for some reason on this show, it seems to be the weather's no good on Saturday, but it's better on Sunday. I don't know why. Anyway, next week, highs of 24 Celsius, plenty of sunshine this week and a few showers. Next weekend, the 17th and 18th of September, highs of 21 Celsius and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And we're back to the era of Prime Minister's questions. That is that the MPs have all managed to finish their little holiday. And so I thought maybe we should have a little listen to some of those. What are your thoughts about the whole sort of way that the new Theresa May government is functioning, Gary, just before we get into the audio and have a listen to Wednesday?
They haven't come up with anything yet about Brexit, have they? Brexit means Brexit, but what the hell does that mean?
Brexit means Brexit, but what does Brexit mean Brexit mean?
Yeah, it is absolutely shambolic.
Well, I think what she's effectively saying is there's no going back here. There's not going to be a second referendum, which I imagine you want to see.
No, I don't want to see a second referendum. I don't want to see a reversal referendum. What I do want to see, though, is people given a choice as to whether they accept the deal when it's negotiated, as to whether they want that or not.
Well, the other thing that she's made a bit clearer in the last couple of weeks, Martin, is that it does look like we're going to be leaving the single market, because she said there's a red line, and that's to do with immigration, that Westminster needs to and the Home Office effectively needs to be in control of our borders. And I suppose they've decided that, whether it's from the Labour Party or UKIP, that they want these votes for people that voted that way in the referendum. And so in order to take control of your borders, you're going to be outside the single market. Isn't that just the case?
It is. I think it's disputable whether the vote for Brexit implied leaving the single market. Certainly a substantial...
Well, they've decided it did.
Decided that, but a substantial chunk of people who voted for Brexit did not think they were going to leave the single market.
A lot of them are voting against the present government, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons. I agree.
So, okay, just let me put this to you then. So you think you can control your borders and yet you can stay in the single market?
No, you can't.
Right, in which case it's a pretty clear-cut thing.
No, I know, but I mean, you could say we'd rather stay in the single market than so-called control our borders. Because in actual fact, so controlling the borders...
You can't control the borders even if you think you can.
I mean, you can say we're going to control the borders, but whether you can control the borders is another matter entirely. The world is in flux. You've got neoliberal policies being pursued all over the world, which actually destroys jobs in places like Poland and Mexico, etc. And you've also got wars which have put millions of people on the move. And if you think you can control those flows, you're living in cloud cuckoo.
We're not really talking about asylum seekers here. Well, what do you make of this anyway, Gary? Because you can't really have it both ways. You can't have you in the single market and control your borders.
I'm not the person
borders.
Who said that we could have it both ways.
Right, good.
You're mixing me up with Boris Johnson. Then.
Or Martin.
Well, no, I think that's right. I mean, the right wing of the Labour Party is suggesting that we can redo Brexit and we can perhaps go back in and have another referendum or even block it.
I'm not against having to potentially go back in if people want it.
Well, that's
what
right.
I'm saying is you've got to follow through on the way that it is now. But you've got to ask people, do you want this deal when the deal is in front of them.
Well, it was actually Thangam Debonair, our local MP here in Bristol, who doesn't want to come on this programme at the moment. She's concentrating apparently on her constituency issues. I'd very much like to have a chat to her about the Labour leadership contest on here and put quite a lot of questions to her, but that's not possible. So we'll have a listen to her in a minute. But we'll start with Angus Robertson, who put a question about Brexit at Prime Minister's Questions to Prime Minister Theresa May this week.
Mr Speaker, there's very real concern and worry about the prospects of Brexit, especially in Scotland, where the majority of people voted to remain within the European Union. The UK government has had all summer to come up with a plan, to come up with a strategy. So far, we've just had waffle. So may I ask the Prime Minister a very simple question, but it's quite important. Does she want the UK to remain fully within the European single market?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
What I want for the UK is that we put into place, into practice, the vote that was taken by the UK people of the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. That we get the right deal for the trade in goods and services with the European Union in a new relationship that we will be building with them, and that we also introduce control of the movement of people from the European Union into the United Kingdom. And I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that we can approach the vote that took place on the 23rd of June in two ways. We could try and row back on it, we could have a second referendum, we could say we didn't really believe it. Actually, we are respecting the views of the British people. More than that, we will be seizing the opportunities that leaving the European Union now gives us to forge a new role for the United Kingdom in the world.
Well, I mean, they haven't got a clue what they're doing, have they? There's all sorts of promises we made to people which are not going to be kept, and that's why I'm not in a position of saying that we need to have a reversal or ignore the first referendum. We need to be in a position where when something clear comes in front, people are asked, you know, do you want this?
What do you think are the particular problems then? What hypocrisy can you see in the government position here?
Well, clearly there's some kind of trade-off between good trading relationships and free movement of people. And I think the first thing is they completely failed to make the positive case for movement of people, which is there. There are some potential negatives as well, but they allowed for several years people to go on about all the negatives without challenging it, and therefore people were actually in the position of thinking, well, this is a free ride.
Aren't you on a hiding to nothing here to a certain extent? Because you're saying, oh, there's big advantages in the free movement of people. There's been a decision made there's not going to be free movement of people after we leave the EU.
Can you explain what decision has actually been made? No, you can't.
We're leaving the European Union. It's essentially, isn't it, about sovereignty between Brussels and Westminster?
Well, for some people, but not for others.
But that's what it means. I mean, if you're a sovereign country, you control your own borders. What they were doing with Schengen. No, don't you? In Luxembourg
you don't.
Or whatever?
No.
Well, Luxembourg isn't a sovereign country. Anyone that's part of the EU is not a sovereign country. If you're, say, Norway or Switzerland, they are, because they've kept their own sovereignty.
No.
Both Norway and Switzerland.
Norway. Yeah. And Switzerland.
So you're going to have a bit of both then, maybe?
Well, no, you can't. I mean, the Japanese at the G20 summit, they came up with a 15-page thing saying, if you leave the single market and you don't have freedom of movement of labour, we're pulling out of Britain, and we employ 500,000 of your people directly and probably over 1.5 million indirectly. Now, if people want their sovereignty, they've got to be prepared to accept that Nissan are going to move to Poland.
Well, at what point were the public and ever asked historically whether they wanted open borders or not?
Well,
haven't they been? Or doesn't it matter? Because that was one of the big things that the Brexit referendum was about, sure.
I think, you know, what failed to happen was the reality being explained as things went along. It's certainly the case that the original vote on going into the European market, as it was
the
then...
The common market, yes.
Yeah. Basically, it was a more basic institution then, and there's been gradual steps through there where various things have been granted.
Okay, well, it was mainly Maastricht, wasn't it, which I think was 1992.
It wasn't the only thing.
Well, yeah, but hang on. But that created the European Parliament. That also... made some serious big difference. That was when the whole thing about Schengen and all that started to unfold. But that was done by John Major, because Mrs. Thatcher refused to sign it. And she was booted out as a result of saying, well, I'm not having this, you know. She was removed at the end of the 1990s.
I think she was
signed
removed rather more to do with the poll tax than Europe. But
well, some people think that. I mean, but it seems that was one of the major reasons, certainly why my reading of it is that Mrs. Thatcher was, you know, absolutely adamant about British sovereignty, blah, blah, for whatever reason, whether she's right or wrong. And so she wouldn't sign the Maastricht Treaty. And so then she was... You know, John Major was brought in to do it for her. But okay, so you're saying that's a myth?
Well, I think there's all sorts of complicated reasons, but certainly the poll tax was a massive amount to do with the removal of Mrs. Thatcher. She got it completely wrong. And you know, her party could actually see that she'd led them up a blind alley.
That was cooked up by good old what's his name, Waldegrave, down at Tewton Mendip, wasn't it?
Yeah, very
good poll tax. Yeah. Great idea, and Victor Rothschild. But anyway, Martin, what's your view on that business with Margaret Thatcher, and you know why she was? There was a bit of a coup within the Tory.
Well, what happened? At the time, I was working in Yugoslavia, and what the British Foreign Office had realised that what the Germans were pushing for, which was de facto and de jure recognition of both Slovenia and Croatia, was going to set off an even bigger war than was already waging. So they'd recommended that we should, and the British position was that these countries should not be given de jure recognition. But in order to keep the Tory party together, John Major, they wanted to opt out of the social chapter of the Maastricht Treaty. Now, all the social chapter of the Maastricht Treaty says is, let's not be beastly to workers, but it doesn't mean, it's got nothing specific in it. It was just it was nothing they could bother about. But they were determined not to sign it to keep the Tory party together. So he was allowed to opt out of the social chapter of the Maastricht Treaty, but the deal Hermit Kohl extracted from him is that Britain would recognise Croatia, which they did, which then set off the war in Bosnia. And of course, that sort of thing is the sort of thing the European Union is, we're talking about war and peace here. It's fundamental. It's not just about, and also, can I just come back to when you're talking about sovereignty? Most people don't know what sovereignty is. There's a 32-county sovereignty committee, which is the political wing of the real IRA. Is that the sort of sovereignty you're talking about? Sovereignty is actually a very, very fungible concept.
Why
in the modern
is it,
era.
Martin, that we only find out about what's the real cause behind things like the Kosovo War, which was a horrific destruction of Yugoslavia, which was, you know, okay, after Tito, it was 10 years or so after he died, it just all fell apart in the most horrific. Why do we only find out about the causes and reasons of these things so long after, maybe 30 years after the event?
Because there's all sorts of stuff going on which is more complicated than the average punter in the back of a bus really understands.
And that how
you keep buses out of this, man.
Well, it's also
it's all people in cars too. You know?
I think it's fair to say London media is not doing its job. You know, it's not telling us what's going on. Anyway, look, let's have a listen to Thangam now, who also had something to say about Brexit in relation to the universities. Local MP for Bristol West. Oops, sorry, that's not her, is it? Let's try.
Thangam Debonair.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And may I add my warm wishes to those of the Prime Minister, to all Paralympians, and particularly Bristolians. I know they'll do us proud. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the whole House will be delighted that this country hosts a disproportionate number of the world's finest universities. Yeah. However, some of them are saying that they are already being shut out of important collaborations with other fine universities in the European Union in anticipation of Brexit.
It's already happening.
This is such an important thing for important scientific, medical, engineering, other research, and for our economic prosperity. In view of this, can the Prime Minister please tell us what her strategy is?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
Can I first of all say to the Honourable Lady how very good it is to see her in this place, in her place in this House? And on the issue of universities, of course we agree of the importance of our universities and the work that they do and the research collaboration that they have with a number of other countries, both within the EU and elsewhere. That's why, earlier this summer, my right honourable friend, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, made an announcement giving certain guarantees to universities in relation to funding decisions that are being taken by the European Union. We're standing behind our universities because we recognise the value that they bring to the country.
Well, she's quite right to raise the question, because it's not just a matter of the British government giving a grant to the universities. Mind you, they spent the so-called savings from not being in the EU about six times over already. But the collaboration is absolutely vitally important, and it's the exchange of ideas and the exchange of expertise across borders. That's one of the things that's actually going to suffer.
Isn't it actually better for universities to compete a bit rather than say, well, look, you know, here's one university, we're better than you, and then they have a sort of almost like a running race competition to make the best, the greatest, fantastic new discoveries?
Well, they do compete in terms of their reputation, but at the same time, they do also have to cooperate. We're absolutely dependent on a lot of universities, on a lot of foreign students coming in. But, you know, there's universities in this area are now thinking, will these students that we've made offers to some months ago, are they going to turn up in 2 weeks' time? I mean, it's as hair-raising as that.
Martin?
Well, I think that's basically right. I mean, the Erasmus programme, for example, which is very important for postgraduate students, that will all have to go. I mean, it's like a lot of things about Brexit. If we're not going to get the funding from the European Union, which is built in now for universities and various other organisations, where's the money going to come from? And if they say, well, we'll just get our money back from the EU, if we stay inside the single market, we will have to pay into the EU budget anyway, like Norway and Switzerland do. If we're really going to leave, we're really going to leave, then we'll have to lose all the Japanese investment, which hasn't been explained to the people in the northeast who voted for Brexit. But I think they need to confront that. The Japanese basically laid it on the line in Beijing when they were talking. It wasn't Beijing, was it? It was somewhere else. They've got a 15-page summary of what their demands are. And the Japanese have got sovereignty, and they've got their demands. We invest an awful lot in your country. We employ 500,000 of your people directly, 1.5 million indirectly, and we're going somewhere else unless you listen to us.
Can you not have sovereignty about making your own laws, but then actually have free trade of some sort, you know, or maybe minimal tariffs as well? That's
But in actual fact, what you're doing, you're begging the question, what does sovereignty mean in the modern era?
It means making your own laws. That's what it means.
No, it doesn't. Because if you're trading with other countries, like Japan, for example, who are inwardly investing in your country, their demands are going to be on the table. You can ignore it. You've got sovereignty to say, right, take your money and go away. But how are we going to replace the money that the Japanese have brought in?
What's trade got to do with, for example, what you do if someone commits manslaughter?
But most of what this is about the rules and regulations surrounding.
The whole world does not revolve around trade, does it?
Pretty much.
There's cooperation, there's exchange of ideas and exchange of services. And basically, you cannot cut yourself off completely and still function as a modern country. It can't happen.
Sounds like the Americans talking here. You just have to. There is no other way. Or even Margaret Thatcher. Yeah? It's my way or no way kind of
attitude. I'm afraid it's that the Americans are in danger of trying to cut themselves off. Now, they're rather bigger than us.
I mean, why is there this fear? It seems to me a fear of having lots of plurality. Well, countries with lots of different approaches to the way to do things. Different ideas of maybe what's right and what's wrong and morality. Because it seems, you know, Brussels and Washington, places like that, the morality that they're imposing in their legal system is miles away.
Brussels are not imposing. We're part, for the moment, of the European Union.
It's the Commission. Just let me finish what I was saying, which is the kids can see it's wrong, you know, a lot of the stuff that's going on, and yet that we're being this stuff is being imposed from on high of us. Anyway, Gary, what do you think?
Well, we're part of the process. We actually did a lot of good for Europe while we were actually in it in a number of areas.
Well, we still are, yeah. At least the next couple of years.
I think, you know, take a simple example. Animal welfare standards in farming, you know, we actually helped to push those up very considerably. And it's part of a single market that you can't have some countries that are sort of reducing standards and therefore reducing their prices and undercutting the countries that are actually maintaining higher standards. And Europe has been all about improving higher quality standards in terms of employment and in terms of things like animal welfare and environmental standards.
How have they allowed things like 0 hours contracts? That's no good for anybody, is it?
And that's a British invention, isn't it?
Right, but as part of the EU, how are the EU allowing it? I mean, surely if there's workers' rights, then they shouldn't allow that kind of thing.
Well, I think there's always a balance.
I bet it's an American invention, actually.
Well, it possibly is.
I don't know. Martin, anyway.
Well, listen, once you start talking about how you're actually practically going to do things, whether it's bus services or anything else, you're talking about compromises. Absolute sovereignty doesn't exist. You know, when Sinn Féin come to power in Dublin, as they aspire to do, they are not going to be able to do what they want in a country of
If you were at the G20 lecturing the Chinese on this, for example, last weekend, they would kick you out of the room. Sovereignty doesn't exist?
It exists to the 9-dash line, but the Philippines don't accept that 9-dash line because they've been pushed by the Americans from behind to pick a fight with the Chinese about it. The problem is my sovereignty conflicts with your sovereignty. So which sovereignty is going to prevail? Oh, I think that's to do with guns, isn't it? Not about trade at all.
Well, no, you can talk to somebody like Craig Murray, who's an expert on maritime law. But anyway, Gary. Yeah.
I think probably the country with the most clear sovereignty that isn't involved elsewhere is North Korea.
But that's right. They've got sovereignty and nuclear weapons.
Yeah. I mean, they don't bother with all this negotiating, working in trade pacts and all the rest of it. They're fine. They're doing fine by themselves.
And what about Iceland?
Well, Iceland were
they're very, not in the European
no,
Union.
No, Iceland were very lucky because all, I mean, what they did is they dumped all the British local authorities and other organisations which were owed money by Landsbanki and Icesave. They refused to get only as Icelandic citizens were allowed to claim their money from the banks after they were nationalised. But all the British local authorities, etc., that money was then that tab was picked up by the taxpayer, by us. So we've bailed out Iceland. Good for Iceland, not so good for us. That's their sovereignty, but it's a pain in the neck for us, eh?
Well,
not our sovereignty.
That's what it's about. This is about negotiation and being, you know,
exactly.
Having negotiations with people around the world. So that over trade, but let's surely allow countries to do what they want. We don't have
like
to
Saudi
have
Arabia.
One kind of control
yeah.
freak.
Saudi Arabia should just be allowed to do what they like with
well,
their
Well, not necessarily Saudi Arabia. Not exactly.
Oh, so they're not to have sovereignty.
Well,
okay.
No.
I agree.
I personally don't think, because they're totally, it's basically a total oligarchy. Anyway, talking of oligarchies, it's interesting this week to see the way that Keith Vaz was removed as chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee after insisting that Lowell Goddard come before the committee this week, and yet before the week was even begun, poor old Keith Vaz is no longer sitting in his chair at the Home Affairs Select Committee. Lowell Goddard, you might remember, was the third person in line to chair the VI paedophile inquiry, which was supposed to have been started last year. It still hasn't even got going. And this week, Gary, we hear from some of the groups that are supposed to be involved of survivors of child sexual abuse. They have no confidence in the inquiry anymore. So it's conflating possibly two different stories here, but I'm interested to see that Keith Vaz was gotten out of the way with this journalistic sting last weekend in the Mirror. Interestingly, the Mirror say that they didn't take the films, these secret films, and it does make you wonder, if a newspaper's not done this sting, who has?
I haven't the faintest idea, and I'm not likely to find out, and I don't think you will either. I think that the inquiry, I mean, tragic things have happened over a lot of years, and unfortunately the scale of that inquiry trying to cover absolutely everything, I think it's quite frankly impossible.
Well, what she said, Lowell Goddard, this is unofficially to I think some Newsnight journalists, there was actually a very good piece on that this week. I occasionally watch Newsnight, it's so boring most of the time, it's not really got anything really fascinating in there, but one of the things, they had a very good report this week about it, and on Newsnight they're saying effectively that this that it looks as if she just simply wasn't happy not being able to appoint her own staff. She was given a whole load of staff from the Home Office. These are the people who are going to run this inquiry, and she's saying, well, I can't work with these people because some of them are actually part of a legacy of covering up abuse at the Home Office, so they're not the appropriate people to be my staff to run this inquiry. And that looks as if after she said that, then effectively she was sacked rather than if she's given a nice letter of resignation. But anyway, is it appropriate, do you think, for her to be told, she's got to run an inquiry, what staff she's allowed to and not allowed to use in that inquiry?
I think that she was given an impossible job right from the beginning.
Well, you could argue that she should have control over her staff, but then, you know, what's the purpose of the inquiry? Is it to find out what happened or to keep the ball kicked into the long grass and for everybody to you know, get bored with it and move on to the next thing?
Is there any point in being in charge of an inquiry when someone else is telling you these are the people that are going to be your staff?
They're doing reruns of Yes Minister, and I think this subject has come up fairly recently. And well, I tell everybody that it's not just a comedy show, it's a really good training video.
Well, I mean, as you're probably aware, the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland have been calling for an inquiry into collusion between the security forces and the loyalist paramilitaries for years and years and years. But they won't accept a British inquiry because British inquiries are no longer judicial inquiries as they used to be. They used to be judicial inquiries and they were actually had a legal basis, whereas the changes in the inquiry law some years ago now mean that they're essentially political setups which can be fixed, and that what they're calling for is an international inquiry into what went on. They're not going to accept a British inquiry because British inquiries are basically whitewashes.
What about, just going back to this thing, Martin, though, about being able to pick your own staff. Surely this, I mean, it seems to me amazing that you could be running an inquiry when you don't have confidence in the people who are literally answering the phones, dealing with the paperwork, and that they may possibly be implicated in past cover-ups of VIP default abuse.
Well, that's why she's obviously, that's the reason she's given, let's take her at face value, that's why she doesn't want to do it. Because she said, I haven't got sufficient independence to do this properly. And that's the point I was just making. British inquiries are, by and large, cover-ups.
Also, going back, yes, and you're right, because it's ministers that decide the bounds of the inquiry rather than judges, which is totally wrong. And that's happened ever since the 7/7 London bombings. But going back to Keith Vaz for a minute, he was also a very important Labour National Executive meeting in making sure that Jeremy Corbyn was kept on the ballot, because there was a legal challenge or possibility of a legal challenge, actually within, well, I don't know if it was a legal challenge, but within the National Executive, that there could have been a vote to say that Jeremy Corbyn could not be on that ballot, and Keith Vaz was one of the people who was instrumental in making sure he was.
Well, I don't know where you get that from, because as I understand it, nobody knows what happened in that 9-hour meeting.
Well, it's
nobody knows who said
it's
what.
It's a Huffington Post article, and I'll put it on. It's a very good article.
Well,
if he did, then
I would obviously approve of that particular position that he took. But I think that was a very weird meeting, because it went on for hours and hours
Right. Well, it's a very good account of it in the Huffington Post, and I'll put a link to that account on our webpage, which is www.thisweek.org.uk, and you can go to this week's show and you can comment, or you can leak, or you can moan as much as you like at us. What we really like, though, is if you can give us a few tips for interesting stories that you want us to cover in future weeks, and that's thisweek.org.uk. You'll find that, and we'll see. Also, what do you make of Chukwuemeka, Martin, being earmarked to take over from Keith Vaz on the Home Affairs Select Committee? This is a really important committee, isn't it? Everything that the Home Office does, which includes things like MI5, the Secret Services, internal Secret Services, the police, the prisons, everything to do with borders, etc. And traditionally, you have somebody from the opposition party chairing the commission, this committee, which scrutinises the Home Office's work.
Well, if he wants to do it and there's enough support for him to do it, no doubt he'll end up running it. Can I just comment about Keith Vaz's bad behaviour, supposedly? It looks like he bought sex from two young men who were over the age of consent. There was some hint that we're going to use poppers in that particular encounter, which are legal drugs, although he also suggested apparently next time they visited they might want to bring some cocaine, which is an illegal drug. And some people say, well, this is all terribly embarrassing and unfortunate for him, because he's a married man with two children. But on the other hand, what I would say is he's behaved like a normal human being who does in fact engage in the sort of things that Home Affairs Select Committees are supposed to actually be having a view on. And maybe he's probably one of the few of them up there who's actually had some experience of what really goes on in the real world. Maybe he should be kept in place.
This is almost like celebrity shows. It really is pretty thin stuff, isn't it?
What you mean, the reasons that he's been removed?
Yes.
Is thin?
Yeah, I mean,
it's pretty silly.
It doesn't look brilliant, but, you know, I mean, when you think of some of the things that people have got away with over the years, it does look pretty thin.
What made me laugh is he apparently claimed to these two Polish lads that he was having sex with that he was a washing machine salesman. And he thought, well, don't these boys watch telly? You know, they must have seen him on there sometimes. He's not a washing machine salesman, is he?
Okay, finally, would you either or both of you like to guess who did do the filming, Martin, you first? If it wasn't the Daily Mirror, somebody did that filming. Somebody conducted that sting.
You'd have to ask the Polish lads who did the filming. Maybe they did it as a freelance. And because maybe they'd seen him before and realised who he was, and they could make some money at it. That's a possibility.
Do you think he's the only politician that there's film and pictures of like this?
I think one of the problems for politicians is that when they do stuff like this, they are well known, you know, and they're vulnerable. But being human beings like they are, do you remember the Monica Lewinsky and the cigar and all of that?
It almost seems to me, look, call me cynical, Gary, but it almost seems to me is you won't get to be a really top politician in one of these key positions unless there are photos of you, unless there is film of you that can be used to blackmail you.
Well, I think that there's certainly been a lot of comment over the years that politicians have to be desperately boring to get to the top, because otherwise somebody's going to squeeze them in one way or another. And I think there's probably a bit of truth in that.
Certainly was with Keith Vaz anyway. Look, with oligarch, another one.
I don't think Winston Churchill would have survived very long in the present day climate.
Was oligarch killed over Prince Philip porn pictures? We don't often do the Sun stories on here, but Boris Berezovsky was assassinated by British secret services because he had highly embarrassing photos of Prince Philip, an author sensationally claims. Now, Martin, you sent me this one during the week, and it's not every week you send me an interesting Sun story. Most of the time, we ignore pretty much what they say, but Russian tycoon Boris Berezovsky apparently was assassinated by British spies after threatening to expose photographs dubbed royal porn, allegedly featuring a young Prince Philip, a Moscow espionage author sensationally claimed. Pictures said to show the Duke of Edinburgh at Thursday club parties were rumoured to have been taken by his photographer friend Baron Nahum in the 1950s. Private photographs thought to have been secretly copied by a Soviet spy who smuggled them back to Russia during the Cold War. Sokolov wrote a biography of GRU agent Ivanov, famous for seducing Christine Keeler, who was the lover of British War Minister John Profumo. Now, this is going back to the 60s. Is there really any possibility of this being true, Martin?
Well, I mean, the Sun have printed it, so what can I say? It's the sort of thing that you read in the Sun. But I think why I sent it to you, because it just shows that the official story of what happened with Berezovsky, which is the coroner, in fact, said that it was definitely foul play, but they then left it at that. And, of course, the implication is that because Berezovsky was Putin's ally and then became his opponent, that Putin might have done him in, because he obviously strangled himself in his own bathroom, supposedly. Now, the coroner in the local area didn't accept that as a, you know, he said it was an open verdict. They weren't willing to accept it as suicide. He didn't leave any suicide note. But you've got to remember that people like Berezovsky were involved in the privatisation of Russia in the 90s and so on. These people have got pretty cheesy pasts. And there's all sorts of possibilities about who may have done him in. It may or may not have been Putin. I suspect not, actually. One of the problems with Berezovsky is he kept calling for the West to pick up the whole thing about the bombings of Moscow in 1999 and said that Putin did it, and I know he did it because I helped him, and I don't think the Western powers wanted to run with that, because that would open up a can of worms for them. So there's all sorts of people with a motive for doing in Berezovsky.
Well, let's move on to another news story. This week we hear about grammar schools, a marvellous new proposal by the government saying that grammar schools are actually good for us, and also that they are going to start to allow individual faith schools to have all people from one faith, rather than at the moment the rules are you can only have half. Anyway, what do you make of this, Gary? I imagine you think it's a crazy idea.
The second bit I'm very much more concerned about. I think it will not be good for social cohesion at all. I think we've seen the problems in Northern Ireland there, where there's been complete separation of children for a number of years. It is not good for society, and I don't think that having schools that can segregate in that way is healthy at all.
Well, I mean, first point I'd make is none of this is in the Conservative manifesto, so they've got no mandate for it. It's just a wish, you know, a wish list for crusty old Tories who'd like to go back to the 1950s.
Things that governments do anyway, they are not in the manifesto.
No, but I mean, the point is that I work in education. We get loads of nonsense from the top all the time. They keep changing what we're supposed to be doing. Now they're changing something we're supposed to be doing without, you know, just on a whim, basically. And of course, if we're going to have grammar schools, that means that we've got to go back to having secondary moderns in an area. If you're going to have a grammar school, that means that 80% of the kids have to go to schools where the top 20% have been creamed off. And also, of course, what we used to have when I did the 11 pluses last year that it was on, it was an intelligence test. And what was the problem with that is loads of doctors and lawyers and teachers, their kids didn't pass it, and they had to go and learn how to be mechanics.
The thing
they didn't
is,
like that.
Apparently these Catholic schools are extremely successful at educating young people up to university standard. Why can't they, if they're so good, why can't they just decide who's coming in and who's
well,
not?
Well, it's because only for Catholics then. Really good schools, but only for Catholics. Now, if they're really good schools like London Oratory, Tony Blair's boy went, you have other people who are not Catholics in there, and the Catholics are actually used, you know, if we're going to have Catholic schools, there's a real question about whether the reason we've got Catholic schools is because of the deal that was done with the Irish nationalist movement
so
in the 1870s in Ireland.
Schools, even though they're the most successful schools out
there. I don't think that any school should be run by a religious organisation.
Well, that's
ideally.
That's the only way that schools got the kids away from their parents in the first place, was saying we're going to give them a good moral education.
Well, listen, the history.
I'm talking about hundreds of years.
the history of all of this. Are you happy to have absolutely 100% Islamic schools where everybody in the school is a Muslim? They've got to be a Muslim to go.
Surely, you know,
pay for by you.
Surely that's the whole point of having these.
No,
these
now the existing rule is that you
state schools, free schools, and faith schools is that is you know that's part of the deal. If you have a faith school, it's a faith school. Otherwise, it's not.
For a modern society to work, people have got to be able to have multiple identities. They've got to be able to. You've got to be able to recognise their culture. And that culture might be important to them.
I mean, surely in an Islamic school, you're not only having Islamic education, you're also...
Well, that's just what the government is saying should happen.
Well, I think the case of Northern Ireland is an obvious point. Because of the 1870 rules, the Catholic Church lobbied in the 1870s that if there was going to be national education in Ireland, they wanted to run it. And as a sop to the Irish nationalist cause...
So was
cause,
the troubles caused by school kids going to different schools?
Well,
no, it wasn't.
It certainly contributed.
It's contributed enormously to the segregation
in that society.
Example,
I remember seeing some fantastic work being done about the whole rave scene in Northern Ireland back in the 1990s when... loads of kids from all different faiths, whatever, and none.
Yeah, but they
were all going to race together. But the government then came and stopped those raves.
Yes, all right, but that may be so. But it's nothing to do. They all went to different schools, and it was only at raves they met each other or at riots. And that's the flipping problem, isn't it?
Well, I think that you've got to have a society where people learn to get along with people who are slightly different than them. And if you cut people off completely, then you've got difficulties. One of the reasons why relations in Bristol are significantly better than some of the northern towns, and large northern towns, is because there, in some cases, you have half the town that's white and half of it which is Asian, and they don't mix. In Bristol, we have a great situation where all sorts of races mix together very well, all sorts of cultures, and that's healthy.
What about grammar schools, Gary? No problem with those?
We haven't seen the detailed proposals yet. I'm very sceptical, although I did go to a grammar school myself and enjoyed it, and it was successful.
Well, I went to a grammar school for 1 year, which became comprehensive. Can I just make this point?
Yeah, but your year would have been grammar, wouldn't it?
Well, first
carry
year.
On through.
First year. When we did the 11 plus, it was...
Well, did they mix people up? Martin, because this is very strange. You go to a school, if it's a selective school, you will go through the whole of that school as still as selective through the years, won't you?
No, it wasn't like that.
So they brought people in...
No, they amalgamated the two schools in Leinster. One was the secondary modern, one was the grammar school.
Oh, okay.
So that's what happened. And, of course, in many rural parts of Britain, there's only really room for one school anyway. Don't forget, if you're going to have selection, some people have to fail. And also, of course, during the grammar school era, they originally it used to be based on maths, English and science tests or whatever. And, of course, the middle class could rig that. When intelligence tests were brought in, the middle class suddenly found that their grammar school places for their kids are not necessarily there. And the other thing, if I can just finish, is girls did much better in those tests than boys. If you're going to have a fair selective system, you've got to allow more girls to go to grammar school than boys.
Isn't it just a basic fact that some kids are better at academia and others better at practical stuff?
Yes, that's true, and that's why we need to have every child's needs need to be dealt with, and it's not just about the cream.
But also people develop at different stages in their life. Some of them have spurts in terms of the way they move forward well after 11, and for some of those people, the rigid system that we had before was not good. It wasn't helpful at all. And also, it was very much a system of 20% get everything and 80%, well, I'm sorry, pal, but you failed. Now, you know, practical education in this country also was very poor. And I'm afraid on the continent we didn't have that situation of winners and losers because some people were better at practical subjects.
But look, the real divide between winners and losers surely is public and private education, not grammar school or secondary modern.
Yes.
So that's what we need to sort, surely. Anyway, look, there was also it's called the Big Housing Conversation this week, Wednesday evening, at Bristol City Council. They're doing them apparently three times a year, and they're listening to everybody around the city about how they want to sort the housing crisis out, which is great. So here's a little clip of Paul Smith, the Labour councillor, speaking at that.
I'd really be interested to hear the views of people in this room, maybe today, maybe in 4 months' time, or whenever, or through other mechanisms. But firstly, our letting system. Personally, I think the way, you know, councils like Bristol, councils all over the country have been forced into having letting systems, which are actually a disgrace.
interesting way to start, because he's saying effectively that it's a kind of almost you're playing like a computer game to try and get somewhere to live, Gary.
There are problems, but there'll always be problems if you've got very few houses and lots of demand.
I agree with that, but I think the online knowledge you need to use the system discriminates against those who haven't got that facility, you know, particularly older people and people with less education.
Was it always going to be like that? If you're going to go over to this points-based system where you're actually having to bid yourself, I mean, the most vulnerable people simply aren't going to be able to get near a computer, let alone do the bidding.
Well, in actual fact, that system's been in place for quite some while, effectively.
It's about 8-10 years now, isn't it? But before that, you basically just filled out a form, and then someone would call you and say, right, we've got somewhere for you, once you got to the top of the list.
Well, yes, 27 years later, which isn't exactly a wonderful system either.
Okay, well, that conversation will go on. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6, thanks to our guest, leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. After the news, we go on the road to Damascus and look at the 15th anniversary of 9/11.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.